Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Lawmakers and law enforcement officials continue to grapple with the impact of yesterday's major Supreme Court ruling regarding juveniles and the criminal justice system. The High Court ruled 5-4 that juveniles convicted of murder cannot be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The ruling affects 29 states, including Massachusetts, and is something of a culmination of a years-long trend where the High Court and at least those 29 states seem to have been moving in different directions when it comes to the constitutionality of severe juvenile sentences. For more on this, we're joined now by James Fox, professor of criminology, law, and public policy at Northeastern University. Professor Fox, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
So, from your experience and when the court sort of makes these major rulings about juvenile justice, how long does it take to really trickle down to the state level when it comes to its practical application?
Well, it could take a long time or a short time. It depends on the state. But let me point out there was one major inaccuracy in the introduction, I apologize to say, which is the court did not abolish life without parole for juveniles. They abolished mandatory life without parole for juveniles. In other words, a state like Massachusetts, every juvenile, 14 or over, who was charged with homicide, with murder, was automatically tried as an adult, and if convicted of first-degree murder, was automatically given life without parole, no matter what the circumstances behind the crime and the criminal. That's where the court said we were wrong, that we must indeed consider characteristics, mitigating factors pertaining to the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
Some states do, but 29 states do not.
I actually appreciate the clarification, and I do apologize for the error in the lead. But on that note, I mean, it seems to me over the past 7 or 8 years, sort of a series of cases that have moved the Supreme Court to where we find ourselves this week. And you know, for example, back in 2005, there was Roper versus Simmons, where the Supreme Court basically said capital punishment could not be, or the death penalty could not be applied to juveniles. Then, you know, in 2010, there was Graham versus Florida, which said mandatory life without the possibility of parole could not be applied to juveniles who, you know, had been convicted of non-homicide cases. And then this week we have the latest ruling. So what do you make of this sort of trend in rulings from the Supreme Court?
Well, it's a gradual step-by-step process to make our laws more in line with science, particularly the science of brain development of teenagers, as well as more in line with what other nations around the world do. We have been out of step. Actually, the trend started in 1988 when the Supreme Court abolished or found unconstitutional the death penalty for juveniles under 16. And then in Roper, they extended it to all juveniles, 18 and under. I mean, under 18. So there has been a slow process. We haven't finished yet. And I think that had the Supreme Court indeed ruled that life without parole for juveniles was categorically unconstitutional, we might have reached the goalpost, but we have more work to do.
Hmm. Justice Elena Kagan, writing for the majority in her decision, wrote that although we do not foreclose the sentencer's ability to make that judgment in homicide cases, alluding to what you said before, it's just the mandatory nature they were objecting to, we require it to take into account how children are different and how those differences counsel against irrevocably sentencing them to a lifetime in prison. So essentially that's the justices saying what you were hinting at, that in a way there's a science has won them over.
Well, science won them over. The brain development is different. We also know that juveniles are much more impacted by external forces, peer pressure, for example, than our adults. And we also know that juveniles are much more amenable to change. That if we do believe that there's a possibility of rehabilitation, juveniles are much more likely to change over the life course than a hardened 40-year-old criminal. Now, the way to get out of this box, actually, and the Supreme Court sidestepped this, is just to abolish life without parole for juveniles. That is, take all juveniles and say who have life sentences and say, okay, you have life sentences, but at some point you have the possibility of parole. That doesn't mean there's a guarantee of parole.
Mm-hmm.
So the kind of most ruthless criminals that the minority justices were concerned about don't necessarily have to get paroled. You can still get a life sentence. You can still stay behind bars forever with life with parole. We only wish to see there to be the possibility of parole so the juveniles who do indeed change over the decades have the opportunity for seeing freedom again.
On the other hand, there are some Massachusetts district attorneys who see this quite differently. I mean, for example, Middlesex DA Jerry Leone released a statement yesterday where he writes that, quote, "The stark and cold reality is that there exist persons under the age of 17 who have committed deliberately premeditated and or extremely atrocious or cruel homicidal crimes and should be held accountable as such by serving a life without parole sentence."
Well, that's a judgment call. I mean, there are countries where no one serves life without parole. In fact, I just got back yesterday from Iceland, where the maximum penalty for homicide, no matter what the age of the perpetrator, is 16 years. America is at the extreme in terms of the kind of sentences we give. There are indeed some rather ruthless juvenile murderers, and they should stay in prison for a long period of time, but why not make the decision down the road whether they're rehabilitated or not, as opposed to making it now when emotions are high in the courtroom and you have families of victims who are concerned and families of perpetrators who are concerned. So basically, rather than making the decision at the front end as to which kids should be eligible for parole and which ones should not, let's just make them all eligible for parole and make the decision down the back end.
So, Professor Fox, briefly, my last question to you is that, you know, one thing that Chief Justice John Roberts wrote in his dissent was that the court's ruling really doesn't address the issues or the societal issues that go into, you know, potentially leading juveniles down the road to crime to begin with. I mean, that's actually something that we heard over the course of the day speaking with law enforcement officials, that there's little in this ruling that helps them figure out, you know, when kids, you know, before they enter the criminal justice system and even maybe after they're out, like how to support them such that we reduce the crime rate overall.
Well, that's true, but that has nothing to do with our sentencing policy for homicide. We need to reinvest in crime prevention programs for kids, absolutely. We need a balanced approach. We need to invest in prevention, and we also need to make sure the sentences are just. And just doesn't necessarily mean that because a child has taken a life that they have to give up their life forever.
James Fox is a professor of criminology, law, and public policy at Northeastern University. Professor Fox, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Still ahead, we throw King George's tea into Boston Harbor again at the brand new Tea Party Ships and Museum.
Let me ask you, do you want to pay the king's taxes?
No!
Do you want your children to pay 10 pence on the very air they breathe?
No!
Then let King George know our intentions.
Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.